Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 3rd, 2026. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article from the Republic entitled A Legacy Endured. Then we'll move on to Valley and State News and conclude the first hour with national and world news from USA Today. Our feature front page article again is entitled A Legacy Endured. The subtitle is Businessman and Civil Rights Leader Lincoln Ragsdale Changed Phoenix. This is by Greg Moore. Lincoln Ragsdale's story is remarkable no matter how you tell it. He grew up in the shadows of a racist massacre, became a Tuskegee Airman, desegregated Luke Air Force Base, integrated Phoenix schools, erased housing red lines, organized with Martin Luther King Jr. He was the reason Arizona wasn't the Mississippi of the West, and today there's talk of naming in his honor a new $4 billion terminal at Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport, a place where, back in the day, cafes wouldn't even serve Ragsdale lunch. He made Phoenix an all-American city, the late Reverend George Brooks, a civil rights champion, once said. He made Phoenix an inclusive city. But his story, which somehow grows more remarkable as the years go by, isn't as well known as it should be. It echoes today in an era of new racial challenges. It and others like it are being intentionally erased everywhere, from local school boards to the White House, threatening to set progress back decades and robbing us of lessons in how to turn tragedy to triumph. Ragsdale died in 1995. Had he lived, he would be turning 100 this summer, making it a perfect time to celebrate his life and tell his story. Lincoln was my mentor. Mary Davidson remembers most of Lincoln Ragsdale's story because she was there, and because she thinks her own story wouldn't have been possible without his. The 92-year-old educator was the first Black woman to graduate from the University of San Francisco. She went on to obtain a Ph.D. from Brandeis, and she became dean of the Graduate School of Social Work at Rutgers. "Lincoln was my mentor," she said, "and her older cousin. He used to come and visit me and give me speeches on how I had to be a success and be in the mainstream because I was a Ragsdale." It was a tricky message at the time. In the late 1950s through the 1960s, Black America was trying to decide between separation and integration. Malcolm X and MLK, the Black Panthers or the Democratic Party. And of course, there was the older generation that just wanted to stay out of the way. Davidson remembers being listless. She didn't have much ambition and didn't know what she was going to do with her life. Lincoln, who was more like an older brother than an older cousin, wasn't having any of that. The military-trained civilian pilot was going to talk some sense into young Mary Edna. "He would get in his airplane and fly to San Francisco," Davidson said. "I kid you not, he would park at the airport, come to my house, get a pitcher of water, and start talking. And I would think, oh God, he's going to lecture all day, literally. Sometimes he did, but it worked." Davidson became a political insider and an activist social worker who broke barriers that prevented single men from adopting children, and she helped pave the way for interracial adoption in the 1960s. She later helped start social welfare programs in Russia after the fall of the Iron Curtain. It was Lincoln's encouragement, or badgering, that got her started on a path of success that seems to define the Ragsdale family. Lawyers, judges, academics, business owners, politicians, athletes, philanthropists. "You would be amazed at the success among the people who are Ragsdale descendants," Davidson said. "All of what follows should be in history books. And none of it would have happened if Lincoln's father, Hartwell Ragsdale, hadn't escaped from the 1921 Tulsa race massacre by taking cover under a train." The Tulsa Massacre and what followed. Hartwell and William Ragsdale Jr. could have been the inspiration for Smoke and Stack Moore, the fictional twin brothers in the Oscar-nominated Hollywood film Sinners. Just picture a couple of successful black men, owners of a prominent funeral home, among other businesses, doing their thing in Oklahoma back in the 1920s. They were earning money, falling in love, and planning their futures in the Tulsa district known as Black Wall Street. It had been a separatist dream. And then a mob of angry and scared white men, whipped up by Ku Klux Klan propaganda, decided they had seen enough and launched a coordinated attack on Greenwood. Oklahoma was an early destination for black people fleeing racist oppression in Arkansas, Georgia, Tennessee, and other southern states where Jim Crow laws and lynch mobs limited their freedom in ways they couldn't have imagined after celebrating the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863. It was just a territory when black people started moving there and mixing with native tribes that had been forced to the area along the Trail of Tears. By the 1890s, journalist Ida B. Wells was writing that black people who could afford to move should head west. Wells had visited Oklahoma after her newspaper offices were burned down in Memphis, Tennessee, where she'd had the audacity to write about three of her friends who were lynched. She said, according to Smithsonian Magazine, that black people had the chance of developing manhood and womanhood in this new territory. By 1921, Greenwood, a neighborhood in Tulsa, contained 108 black-owned businesses, including 41 grocery and meat markets, 30 restaurants, 11 boarding and rooming houses, 9 billiard halls, and 5 hotels, according to Tulsa City County Library historians. Greenwood also had 33 black professionals, including 15 physicians and surgeons, 6 real estate, loan, and insurance agents, 4 pharmacists, 3 lawyers, and 2 dentists. 24 skilled craftspersons in the community included 10 tailors, 5 building contractors and painters, and 4 shoemakers. The community's 26 service workers included 12 barbers, 6 shoe shiners, and 5 clothes cleaning shops. It would all be wiped out in one 18-hour frenzy. Arizona State University history professor Calvin Schermerhorn describes it in The Plunder of Black America, how the racial wealth gap was made, one of only 2 history books I could find with anything about Lincoln Ragsdale or his family. Pops of gunfire echoed outside the Home Undertaking Company in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on a summer morning in June 1921. Its 29-year-old owner, Hartwell Ragsdale, didn't scare easily, but he hurried to gather valuables. Black Tulsa was under fire, and Ragsdale's sole consolation was that his wife and the mortuary's co-owner, Lydia, was out of town. Ragsdale could look out the windows at a pillar of smoke. The night before, white mobs had burned and looted African-American homes and businesses south of Greenwood Avenue, which locals called Black Wall Street. Numbers tell a story, but the damage was incalculable. More than 1,400 homes, schools, churches, and businesses over 35 city blocks were either looted or burned to the ground, oftentimes both. Hundreds were killed. Officially, 26 black people and 10 white people died. However, the Red Cross at the time put the actual number as high as 300, nearly all black. The tension started with a trumped-up accusation of rape against a young black man who supposedly assaulted a white woman on an elevator ride. Black World War I veterans grabbed their guns and headed to the jailhouse to prevent a lynching. They were confronted by a bloodthirsty white mob. A shot rang out and all hell broke loose. The destruction was total. About 10,000 white people participated in the well-organized assault. Attackers flew crop dusters over Black Wall Street to shoot at and drop bombs on buildings and people below. Some, like the Ragsdales, were tipped off before the chaos started. Hartwell ducked and dodged his way to the train station, where he hid under a boxcar and waited to jump on board as it finally chuffed away. Most others weren't as fortunate. The Commission to Study the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921 said that Black Wall Street business owners filed about $5 million in insurance claims, about $86 million in today's dollars. None of the claims were paid out. The American Journal of Economics and Sociology said in 2018 that if 1,200 median-priced homes in Tulsa were destroyed today, the loss would be around $150 million. The additional loss of other assets, including cash, personal belongings, and commercial property, might bring the total to over $200 million. Hartwell Ragsdale got away to Kansas City. William Ragsdale stayed. Within 2 years, he was killed. A direct attack on a vibrant community. About 3,000 people showed up to William Ragsdale's funeral. His $1,000 casket, the most beautiful seen in Muskogee in recent years, according to the Black Dispatch, was covered in $500 worth of flowers. That's a little more than $27,000 of last respects in today's dollars. A fitting tribute for a guy whose nickname was Boodles, which was slang for money in those days. The extravagance showed that William Ragsdale's death was a very, very big deal, said Brian Hosmer, a historian and the former head of the history department at Oklahoma State University. This is a vibrant community of prosperous people. This is a huge deal. It's a tragedy. And it's a direct attack on them and their community and their existence, right? Hosmer said. You could see the funeral from their perspective as a demonstration of defiance or of their worth. They're saying, we're still here and we're not what you say we are. You, in this case, was the white power structure, supported by the Ku Klux Klan, saying that William Ragsdale was part of a conspiracy to kill a white police officer a few towns away. Based on what was published in newspapers at the time, the official version is tough to swallow. The real problem was that Black people had been working together and getting rich in the years before the Tulsa Massacre and Ragsdale slaying. One of the things that really fuels Jim Crow violence in Oklahoma and other places, Hosmer said, is the existence of prosperous African Americans. The thing about Jim Crow is it's all about hierarchy. The white communities are okay with the presence of non-white people if they're poor and if they're dependent. But if they're prosperous, then that is in some ways a violation of the hierarchy. Newspapers of the day tell the story. William Ragsdale had been connected to the death of a white police officer in nearby Sepulpa. Apparently, Ragsdale's brother-in-law was involved, and that was enough for an accusation. It didn't matter that Ragsdale was at a New Year's Eve party playing cards when the officer was killed in a brawl 17 miles away. Men in police uniform showed up to Ragsdale's home to take him in for questioning. 2 hours later, a phone rang at the Muskogee Times-Democrat. It was an anonymous caller asking if that N-blank had been taken to Sepulpa had been killed. Ragsdale had been beaten, robbed, and executed. Meanwhile, police said he had tried to escape and that they shot him in the back. An autopsy showed signs of a struggle and indications that the fatal shot had been fired from point-blank range, under Ragsdale's chin and through the top of his head. This is the world Lincoln Ragsdale would be born into just a few years later. The family didn't talk about those days often, too much pain in the memories. But Mary Davidson believes Lincoln Ragsdale knew about all of it, the riot, his father's harrowing escape, and his uncle's death. She thinks he used it as motivation. Becoming a World War II pilot to prove I could do it. Lincoln Ragsdale was born in Ardmore, Oklahoma in 1926, about 5 years after his family's funeral home was bombed out of Black Wall Street, about 3 years after his uncle Boodles was shot in the middle of nowhere. Lincoln's father, Hartwell, had returned to the area about a year after the attack. Everything had been burned out, Hartwell Jr., Lincoln's brother said, according to research by ASU's Schermerhorn. Hartwell set about rebuilding his life about 180 miles south in Ardmore. He was frightened of white people, and he felt comfortable in that mostly black community, Lincoln Ragsdale Jr. said in an interview with the Arizona Republic. My father always said he should have gone on to Dallas where there would have been a larger population. Lincoln Ragsdale just never seemed to get the memo that he was supposed to be inferior. He also didn't see any reason why his family's funeral home couldn't only bury black people. He thought the business should be open to anyone grieving from any background. He'd come to realize that dream decades later in Phoenix, but it wouldn't be easy. My father was a very brave man, Lincoln Jr. said, and a very strong man. Strong enough that Lincoln Ragsdale Sr. decided to become a fighter pilot in World War II shortly after finishing high school in Ardmore. I wanted to be a pilot because I wanted to prove something, Lincoln Ragsdale Sr. said in a video provided to the Republic by Lincoln Jr. I had no real desire to fly. The newspaper said that blacks could not do it, and I wanted to prove that we could do it. He did, and he was punished for it severely. On the day the United States commissioned him as an officer in the Army, the Air Force wouldn't be a separate branch until after the war, a police vehicle tailed him in Madison County, Alabama, and several men pursued him down a muddy road and beat him while he was wearing his lieutenant's bar, Schermerhorn wrote. Change, however, was in the air. The United States was winning wars abroad, but ripping itself apart from within over racism. Desegregation efforts started small, like the decision to send Tuskegee Airmen to Arizona's Luke Field, home of the fighter pilot, a few years before President Harry Truman would move to desegregate the entire military in 1948. It wasn't an easy transition. White members of the military refused to salute black officers. Black officers had a hard time finding places to sit in the cafeteria. Lincoln Ragsdale was only going to put up with so much of it. The Arizona Republic's Valley 101 podcast on Ragsdale life has the best version of how he handled integration. They came in December 1945, and Lincoln is put in quarters with a white officer, another pilot. This officer is a captain, and he's from Mississippi, and this is not going to be a good mix, said Ben Bruce, a historian who specializes in the Tuskegee Airmen and their time in Arizona. The pilot came home late one night to find that he had a new roommate, Lincoln Ragsdale. What are you doing here? The white officer asked. I've been assigned here, Ragsdale replied. You're not staying here with me, the white officer responded. Fine by Lincoln Ragsdale. Lincoln didn't leave the room, so the captain did, Bruce said. He ended up sleeping in his car. The next day, he went to his squadron commander and complained. You're not getting a new roommate, the squadron commander said. He slept in his car for 4 more days. You can picture a well-rested Ragsdale walking around the base wearing a crisp uniform with his head held high. Meanwhile, the white captain would have been dragging around with bags under his eyes, rumpled clothes, and terrible posture from sleeping in the car and getting dressed in the parking lot. By the end of the week, the captain was ready to live in the same room as Ragsdale. And so, the captain had to learn to deal with this black man who he grew up being taught was inferior to him, Bruce said. When the war ended, Ragsdale was discharged and decided to return to Arizona. He came looking for the same thing his father and Uncle Boodles were looking for when their father, Stith Ragsdale, sent them from Jim Crow, Arkansas to Territorial, Oklahoma, a fresh start. He saw, Schermerhorn wrote, an opportunity to desegregate a city that was in its startup phase. Phoenix had just grown into one of the 100 largest U.S. cities by population, and it would be 29th largest by 1960. Parts of Phoenix felt like Oklahoma. Taxi drivers would not pick up black riders north of Van Buren Street, and though he had flown a P-51 Mustang fighter, Lincoln could not get a sandwich at Phoenix's Sky Harbor Airport because vendors didn't serve black diners. Ragsdale later said it was the Mississippi of the West when he arrived. He knew it didn't have to stay that way. By the time Ragsdale was done with Phoenix, the schools would be desegregated. Black families could live wherever they wanted, and the airport that wouldn't serve him lunch would have his name on it. Desegregating Phoenix schools before the court ruled. We could spend pages detailing the ins and outs of Lincoln Ragsdale Sr.'s integration work in Phoenix. Both white and African Americans, Native Americans, Hispanics, Jews, the Reverend George Brooks said in a video provided to the Republic by Lincoln Ragsdale Jr. This community owes Lincoln Ragsdale a debt of gratitude that we do not have enough time to pay. Brooks, who died in 2007, led Phoenix's first African-American Presbyterian church and worked side-by-side with Lincoln Ragsdale and his wife, Eleanor Ragsdale. Lincoln and Eleanor helped fight to desegregate Phoenix schools a year before the Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court ruling. The Ragsdales became the first black family to move north of Van Buren and later the first black family in Paradise Valley. In moving to North Phoenix, a white friend purchased the property and transferred the deed to the Ragsdales. One of the homes was vandalized with the word N-blank painted on the door. Lincoln Sr. left it there so they could see where the N-blank lived. Someone from the Homeowners Association painted over it after a few months. Lincoln Ragsdale Sr. also led the campaign to break Phoenix into voting districts that would create more representation for blacks and Latinos on the city's south side. He got Martin Luther King Jr. to deliver a series of speeches, including Religious Witness for Human Dignity at Goodwin Stadium, then home to the Arizona State University Sun Devils football program. It came just days before the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964. Only one audio copy of the speech survived. It belonged to Lincoln Ragsdale Sr. and is part of his archives at ASU. But what was Lincoln Ragsdale Sr. like as a man? And why was he so hell-bent on integration when his family history suggests he might have been just as likely to be a black separatist? Let's go back to Oklahoma when he was just a teenager. He told stories about what it was like to build caskets with his father in the backyard, said Emily Ragsdale, the youngest of Lincoln and Eleanor's four children. He built them with his brother and his father. He tells this story. It was sad. They brought in a baby. They couldn't take the child to the white hospital, so he died. So when they brought the baby in, they put him on the cold slab, and the baby started crying. He wasn't dead. The shock of the cold woke the baby, but then, eventually, he did die because they couldn't get medical help. Lincoln Ragsdale was no older than 14 at the time, and the experience stayed with him forever. You can imagine him standing there next to his father, too hurt to cry, and vowing silently to change the world no matter what it took. It helps explain why he decided to become a pilot and later a civil rights activist. It also helps explain his otherworldly ambition, which is how he met Eleanor. Arizona had a teacher shortage back then, too. Schools in Phoenix were paying black teachers more than they could earn back east. Eleanor Dickey already had family out west. A pair of uncles moved to Arizona for the climate back in the 1920s, so she decided to go for it. Lincoln's buddy showed him a picture of his beautiful young cousin from Philadelphia who was graduating from a Cheney State Teachers College and planning to take a job in Phoenix. My dad fell in love on first sight of the picture, Lincoln Ragsdale Jr. said. He found out when and how she would arrive. Here you can picture Lincoln Sr. getting a haircut, buying flowers, putting on his best suit, and getting a shoe shine to make the best first impression in human history. So when she came and got off the train, my dad was there with her cousin, and that's how they met. My dad worked hard at courting her because I think she had a boyfriend already. You think? Take one look at Eleanor. She was so beautiful that she probably had a line of guys from Phoenix to Philadelphia begging for a chance to ask her out. Lincoln Sr., however, was well-dressed, driven, handsome, educated, and confident. How could she resist? She graduated in 1947 and was Mrs. Lincoln Ragsdale by 1949. Remember here, he was a pilot. He decided Eleanor needed a sable coat, okay? Mary Davidson said. So he took his plane and they flew to Montreal and he bought her a sable coat. This is after they had been married a while. Emily remembers her parents had been fur shopping in Detroit, where a friend told them there was nothing better than a Russian sable. They got back to Phoenix, and Lincoln started working the phones until he found the best furrier around, even if it was in Canada. Then he put Eleanor and Emily on the plane and headed north. Emily was small enough to fit in the luggage compartment of Lincoln's single-engine propeller plane, so that's where she sat. "I loved it," Emily said, remembering. Sometime later, Lincoln took Eleanor to Boston, where Mary was working in the mayor's office. Supposedly, the Ragsdales were there for a visit, but mostly she thought Lincoln was showing off. "I'm in Boston City Hall, in a suite of all the big mucky mucks, right?" Mary said. "Here he comes in. He had an off-white coat, off-white ostrich boots. He was off-white from head to toe, and he bustled in. The whole place was on the floor. He sat in my office and everyone came by to see this black man dressed in a cowboy hat and cashmere coat and boots, with his wife in a full-length Russian sable. He got the money from the funeral home he opened in South Phoenix. It served everyone, regardless of race." A story that didn't fit the mold. Lincoln Ragsdale Sr. died of cancer in 1995. His public legacy included opening at least 8 businesses, including a popular jazz club, the Century Sky Room. He served on more than a dozen board of directors, including the Phoenix Chamber of Commerce, not the Black Chamber, the Phoenix Chamber, the ASU Alumni Association, he was president, and the National Conference of Christians and Jews. He was also an advisor to Ronald Reagan on small and minority business ownership. Having accomplished all of this, how is it that anyone who spent any length of time in Arizona doesn't know the story of Lincoln Ragsdale Sr.? "That's a very good question," said Matthew Whitaker, a prominent historian and director of Phoenix's George Washington Carver Museum and Cultural Center. He wrote the book on Ragsdale, Race Work, The Rise of Civil Rights in the Urban West. Part of it is tethered to the fact that most people don't know much about black history in the state. But he also doesn't fit the mold of historical black figures during this particular time in history. Ragsdale was a businessman, a mortician, not a preacher like MLK, not a journalist like Ida B. Wells, not a scientist like George Washington Carver. But in his way, he was as effective as any of them. Shortly after his death, the executive terminal at Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport was named for him. That terminal is likely to be torn down, however, as the airport expands, but there's a push to name a new $4 billion wing for Ragsdale when it opens in the early 2030s. Expect a fight, though. There will be plenty of people with their hands up to be honored alongside John McCain and Barry Goldwater, whose names grace the current stations. Still, there would be something cinematic about it if it were named for Ragsdale. Imagine a family driving to the airport for a trip home for the holidays, and a little boy looking out of the window and seeing the names Lincoln and Eleanor Ragsdale in huge letters on the side of the building. The boy would say, "Who's that?" His father would say, "You've never heard of Lincoln Ragsdale?" Emily Ragsdale knows exactly how the father would reply. "Oh yeah," she said, "he was a Tuskegee Airman. He helped integrate Phoenix and the Air Force. He really changed Phoenix." From there, you could imagine a Hollywood montage. Propellers spinning, a plane tearing down the runway, memories of a lynching, training at Tuskegee, a man in a uniform being beaten, a plane taking off, a train pulling in, a young couple falling in love, a beautiful wedding, a tiny casket, a newborn fighting for his life, more flights, city council meetings, school integration, a fur coat. And through it all, Lincoln Sr. delivering one consistent message. You've got to be a success. You're a Ragsdale. Do you know what our family has been through to get you here? And you can't just be for blacks. You've got to be mainstream. That was always his message to me, Mary Davidson said. You've got to be mainstream. And that article was entitled, A Legacy Endured, and that was by Greg Moore. We're 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 3rd, 2026. We're going to move on now to Valiant State News. This article is entitled, Tempe Postpones Vote on Half-Cent Increase for Sales Tax. This is by Lauren DeYoung. The fate of a proposed half-cent sales tax increase is still up in the air after the Tempe City Council postponed voting on the issue. City staff have argued the increase is necessary to backfill a $24 million deficit caused by decisions at the state and federal levels, including the repeal of a statewide rental tax. They said the sales tax shifts part of the burden off residents and onto visitors. The hike is expected to raise more than $50 million. But the proposal will look different the second time it goes in front of the council on May 14th. Councilmember Randy Keating, with unanimous approval from the others, amended the 0.5% tax sales tax increase to carve out 0.1% for Tempe PRE, the city-run preschool. We're taking proactive upstream measures here to increase public safety in the city of Tempe, Keating said, arguing that investing in early education and child care reduces future criminality. We're talking about not only addressing the immediate need or public safety, but the future needs that we're really anticipating. The inclusion of funds for Tempe PRE removed a sliver of funds from the proposed public safety pool. If approved, that 0.5% would be split into 0.3% for public safety, which includes police, fire, and improvements to safety like lighting, 0.1% for Tempe PRE, and 0.1% for transit. Residents gave the proposal a mixed reception. The Tempe Firefighters Union, Police Union, and Chapter of Chamber of Mothers supported the tax increase. Tempe Fire and Medical and the Tempe Police Department leaders revealed stark and dire gaps in service time and staffing and said the increased revenue could help fill them. The city is denser, taller, busier, more complex in ways that don't show up on a map, but show up immediately when a call comes in, said Mike Scheit, president of the Tempe Firefighters Union, who spent 27 years as a firefighter. This conversation tonight is about whether the gap continues to widen or whether we do something about it. The proposal in front of you is not that complicated. It's about giving city voters a voice and how safe our community is. Many also spoke in favor of increasing the transit tax to support the local Orbit bus, streetcar operations, and bike lanes. The last time the transit tax was increased was in the 1990s. Kendra Flory, a 22-year-old resident of Tempe, said the transit tax was long overdue. But others, like former City Council candidate Joe Forte, who campaigned on balancing the budget, said this was an opportunity to take a scalpel to the budget and go over it line by line. People will see that when times got tight, your first instinct was reaching for their wallets instead of rolling up your sleeves and doing the difficult work they elected you to do, Forte said. The City Council on May 14th is expected to decide whether to send the 0.5% sales tax increase to the voters for approval. If ratified by voters, it would go into effect January 1st, 2027. And that article was entitled, Tempe Postpones Vote on Half-Cent Increase for Sales Tax. That was by Lauren DeYoung. Our next article is entitled, Families Could Get Right to Put Cameras in Nursing Homes. This is by Helen Rummel. Legislation 3 years in the making could soon protect a person's right to install cameras in their rooms at Arizona assisted living facilities and nursing homes. The bill would require facilities to allow residents to use a monitoring device in their rooms if they choose to install their own, with advocates saying it would prevent the abuse of older adults. Supporters behind the bill said the mistreatment and sexual abuse detailed in The Bitter End, a reporting series from the Arizona Republic, was a driving force behind the legislation. Representative Quan Nguyen, a Prescott Republican, said he has been pushing for the changes for several years, citing his own father's experience in an assisted living facility. Nguyen said his father told him he had been beaten while living at the facility, with some of his belongings later going missing. As a result, Nguyen's family chose not to move his mother into any long-term care facilities, he said. Currently, several assisted living homes allow for video monitoring in a resident's room, but others have stopped families from installing their own cameras, said AARP Arizona Director of Advocacy Brendan Blake. We don't know how many facilities allow for this, Blake said. We believe that there should be an even playing field. Senate Bill 1041 is intended to combat the patchwork of policies, while also stripping providers of any responsibility to install or maintain the cameras themselves. A family member of a resident can also request a camera be added to a room as long as the resident is informed of the monitoring device and agrees. In cases where a person does not have the ability to consent, their representative with power of attorney can consent on their behalf if there are no objections. A person can also choose to include a preemptive rejection of the use of any monitoring devices in their will or other legal documents. AARP of Arizona has advocated for the legislation since its inception, citing a strong interest from families and their loved ones. According to polling conducted by the group, roughly 4 out of 5 Arizonans asked favor cameras being used by nursing homes for monitoring purposes. The polling didn't find any significant changes in opinion along party lines among the more than 1,000 respondents. The legislation has faced pushback from some groups representing assisted living facilities, who argue that some establishments should have the option to bar video monitoring. Jamie Roberts, the chief executive officer for Arizona Leading Age, said his organization was concerned about how the bill would impact the larger market. We serve many individuals, including high-profile community members, for whom living in a camera-free environment is a deeply important personal and legal consideration, Roberts said in a statement. Once this bill passes, that option effectively disappears. Every facility becomes subject to camera installation on request, and there's no longer anywhere to go for those who need that protection. The organization also cited concerns around how cameras in rooms with multiple residents would be handled. Nguyen said the bill allows a resident the option to add their own monitoring device, and if a roommate isn't comfortable with a device, it cannot be installed. Nguyen points to crimes and neglect happening in assisted living homes, including a staffer at a Mesa facility who was arrested in mid-April after he was accused of kissing and groping a resident. The incident was caught on camera installed by the family at the facility. How many more cases do we need to have before the legislature asks, Nguyen said. The bill has seen bipartisan support and passed with wide margins in the House. It will need to pass another vote in the Senate before going to Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs, but timing remains up in the air in the midst of heated budget negotiations. Hobbs has previously shown support for legislation written to protect the residents of long-term care facilities. And that article is entitled, Families Could Get Right to Put Cameras in Nursing Homes. That was by Helen Rummel. Our next article is entitled, Porter to Add 2 Nonstop Canadian Routes from PHX. This is by Michael Salerno. Even with a sharp decline in Canadian visitors to the United States, Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport is getting 2 new routes to Canada. Porter Airlines will begin seasonal service from Phoenix to Edmonton in November and to Calgary in December. The 2 cities in the province of Alberta will follow Porter's year-round flights to Toronto, which will increase to 2x daily starting in the fall, and seasonal flights to Vancouver and Ottawa. The new routes are part of Porter's service expansion from the 2026-2027 season, with 40 routes to warm weather destinations. Phoenix was one of four new routes added out of Edmonton International Airport. The others will fly to Las Vegas, Los Cabos, Mexico, and Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. Edmonton is now home to more nonstop sun routes with Porter than any other airport in Western Canada, a meaningful vote of confidence in Edmonton and a clear response to the growing demand for leisure travel from our region, Edmonton Airport staff said in a social media post. When do Porter Airlines' Phoenix-Edmonton flights start? Porter's flights from Phoenix to Edmonton will begin on November 6th. Flights will operate daily during peak travel periods and four times weekly from November 6th to December 16th and January 6th to February 10th, 2027, with fares starting at $96 one way. When do Porter Airlines' Phoenix-Calgary flights start? Porter's flights from Phoenix to Calgary will begin on December 20th. Flights will operate daily during peak travel periods and five times weekly from January 6th to February 15th, with fares starting at $96 one way. Why are Porter's new Canadian routes a big deal? Porter is the only Canadian airline to add new routes to and from Phoenix since Canadian travelers began making fewer visits to the U.S. About 1.6 million Canadians returned to Canada from the U.S. by air from January to March 2026, down from 1.9 million in the first 3 months of 2025 and 2.2 million in the first 3 months of 2024, according to Statistics Canada, which tracks data on Canadian travelers' return trips from the U.S. and overseas. Experts blame the Canadian travel declines on President Donald Trump imposing tariffs on Canadian goods and calling for Canada to be annexed as the 51st state. Other airlines have cut their capacity in response to the slower demand. Earlier this year, WestJet scaled back flights on its Phoenix-Vancouver and Phoenix-Edmonton routes, citing a notable decline in transborder travel. Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport's 2025 passenger traffic fell 1.3% to 51.6 million passengers, following a record year of 52.3 million passengers in 2024, airport data showed. Airport staff cited a decline in Canadian visitors as the reason for the drop in traffic. Like Porter Airlines' other flights out of Phoenix, the new Edmonton and Calgary routes will fly on an Embraer E195-E2 aircraft, a narrow-body twin-engine plane that can seat up to 132 passengers. What terminal serves Porter Airlines at PHX? Porter Airlines operates out of Terminal 3 at Sky Harbor. What is special about Porter Airlines? Porter Airlines is popular for offering an economy experience with no middle seats, free Wi-Fi, free snacks, and free beverages, including beer and wine served in glassware. Porter Classic Basic and Standard fares require you to pay for seat selection. Flexible and Freedom fares include seat selection. Porter Airlines also offers the Premium Economy Porter Reserve, which includes free seat selection, dedicated check-in, extra legroom, up to two checked bags free, in-flight meals, which cost extra for Porter Classic flyers, and the ability to make changes at no additional charge beyond the difference in fare. And that article is entitled, Porter to Add Two Nonstop Canadian Routes from PHX. That was by Michael Salerno. Now we're going to move on to national and world news with articles from USA Today. We've got two front page articles. The first is on the war in the Middle East, and the second is on Spirit Airlines. First article is entitled, Iran Offers Straight Deal. The subtitle is, Trump Not Satisfied Says U.S. Could Restart Strikes. This is by Parisa Havizay and Jacob Bogage. An Iranian proposal so far rejected by President Donald Trump would open shipping in the Strait of Hormuz and end the U.S. blockade of Iran, while leaving talks on Iran's nuclear program for later, a senior Iranian official said on May 2nd. Trump, who has said repeatedly that Iran can never have a nuclear weapon, said on May 1st he was not satisfied with the latest Iranian proposal, while Iran's foreign minister said Tehran was ready for diplomacy if the United States changes its approach. When asked about Iran's proposal on May 2nd before boarding a flight to Miami at West Palm Beach, Florida, Trump replied, "They told me about the concept of the deal. They're going to give me the exact wording now." He added on his social media channel that he could not imagine the proposals would be acceptable and that Iran had not paid a big enough price for what it had done. Asked if he might restart strikes on Iran, Trump replied, "I don't want to say that. I mean, I can't tell that to a reporter. If they misbehave, if they do something bad, right now, we'll see. But it's a possibility that could happen." While saying repeatedly he is in no hurry, Trump is under domestic pressure to break Iran's hold on the Strait, which has choked off 20% of the world's oil and gas supplies and pushed up U.S. gasoline prices. Trump's Republican Party faces the risk of a voter backlash over higher prices when the country votes in midterm congressional elections in November. Trump spent May 2nd in Florida at his Mar-a-Lago resort and the Trump National Golf Club in nearby Jupiter and also visited the dentist. In the evening, he was due to visit another of his golf resorts, Trump National Doral outside Miami, which is hosting the PGA Cadillac Championship. Reuters and other news organizations already reported over the past week that Tehran was proposing to reopen the strait before nuclear issues were resolved. The official confirmed that this new timeline had now been spelled out in a formal proposal conveyed to the United States through mediators. Iranian media said that Tehran's 14-point proposal included the withdrawal of U.S. forces from areas surrounding Iran, lifting the blockade, releasing Iran's frozen assets, payment of compensation, lifting sanctions, and ending the war on all fronts, including Lebanon, as well as a new control mechanism for the strait. The United States and Israel suspended their bombing campaign against Iran 4 weeks ago, but appear no closer to a deal to end a war that has caused the biggest disruption ever to world energy supplies, roiled global markets, and raised worries about the possibility of a wider global economic downturn. Iran has been blocking nearly all shipping from the Gulf, apart from its own, for more than 2 months. Last month, the United States imposed its own blockade of ships from Iranian ports. Washington has repeatedly said it will not end the war, which has led to the deaths of thousands of people, without a deal that prevents Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, the primary aim Trump cited when he launched strikes in February in the midst of nuclear talks. Iran says its nuclear program is peaceful. Speaking on condition of anonymity to discuss confidential diplomacy, the senior Iranian official said Tehran believed its latest proposal to shelve nuclear talks for a later stage was a significant shift aimed at facilitating an agreement. Under the proposal, the war would end with a guarantee that Israel and the United States would not attack again. Iran would open the strait, and the United States would lift its blockade. Future talks would then be held on curbs to Iran's nuclear program in return for the lifting of sanctions, with Iran demanding Washington recognize its right to enrich uranium for peaceful purposes, even if it agrees to suspend its nuclear program. Under this framework, negotiations over the more complicated nuclear issue have been moved to the final stage to create a more conducive atmosphere, the official said. And that article was entitled "Iran Offers Strait Deal," and that was by Parisa Havazi and Jacob Bogage. Our next front page article from USA Today is entitled "Airlines Scramble to Help Spirit Passengers." The subtitle is "Rivals Cap Fares After Budget Carrier Collapses." This is by David Shepherdson and Layla Kearney. Major airlines and the U.S. government scrambled to help stranded passengers and employees after bankrupt discount carrier Spirit Airlines ceased operations on May 2nd, the industry's first casualty linked to the Iran war. The collapse overnight of the carrier following a doubling in jet fuel prices during the two-month-old Iran war will cost thousands of jobs. It is a blow to President Donald Trump, who had proposed $500 million to save Spirit despite opposition from some of his closest advisors and many Republicans in Congress. Spirit's demise highlights the unintended consequences of the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran, despite an uneasy ceasefire. While Spirit was already struggling to turn a profit before the fuel shock, global carriers are contending with surging jet fuel prices as Iran continues to halt nearly all traffic through the Strait of Hormuz and the U.S. Navy blockades Iranian ports. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy told a news conference that creditors had rejected the deal despite intense efforts by the Trump administration to keep Spirit alive. The collapse will result in the loss of about 15,000 jobs of Spirit employees and contractors, the airline said. Some of Spirit's largest creditors, including Ken Griffin's Citadel, a major hedge fund, and one of the airline's top bondholders, opposed the government-backed rescue, arguing the terms would dilute the value of their claims by placing federal financing ahead of existing debt. Fond tributes on social media. No U.S. carrier of Spirit size, it accounted for 5% of U.S. flights last year, has liquidated in two decades. Spirit helped keep fares lower in markets where it competed against major carriers. On social media platform X on May 2nd, where travelers often go to vent about delayed or canceled flights, many sent nostalgic posts about the budget airline's closure. Goodbye, Spirit Airlines. Those of us in the D, Detroit, or previously known as your second hub of hashtag DTW, will miss ya, said at IUT Truth Tellers 2. Others on X posted stories of their experiences flying on Spirit, including the hashtag RIP in their messages. At Orlando International Airport, a digital departure display sign was filled with bright red notifications of canceled Spirit flights that had destinations everywhere from Nashville to San Juan, Puerto Rico. United Airlines, Delta Airlines, JetBlue, and Southwest are all capping ticket prices for Spirit customers who now need to rebook canceled flights. Customers must provide a Spirit flight confirmation number to qualify. Rival airlines are also offering free seats to help Spirit employees get home. This is the airline industry stepping up, Duffy said. Duffy noted that U.S. low-cost carriers have sought $2.5 billion in government aid to address higher fuel costs, but he did not think a government bailout was necessary at this point. Airline collapsed overnight. Duffy took a swipe at the administration of former President Joe Biden, arguing that its blocking of a merger in 2024 between JetBlue and Spirit paved the way for the airline's collapse. Spirit had filed for bankruptcy protection twice within a year and had not made a profit since 2019. Spirit built its brand around affordable fares for budget-conscious travelers ready to eschew add-ons such as check bags and seat assignments. That demand tapered off after the pandemic as passengers preferred to opt for comfort and experience-based travel, leaving ultra-low-cost carriers struggling to adapt. Spirit shutdown will benefit rivals such as JetBlue and Frontier Airlines, also reeling from the cost shock. Spirit had 4,119 domestic flights scheduled between May 1st and May 15th, offering 809,638 seats, according to data from aviation analytics firm Cirium. Trump said on May 1st that the White House had given Spirit and its creditors a final rescue proposal after talks hit an impasse over a $500 million financing package that would have helped the airline keep operating through bankruptcy. Spirit had reached a deal with its lenders that would have helped it emerge from its second bankruptcy by late spring or early summer. But the spike in jet fuel prices derailed those plans, upending Spirit's cost projections and complicating its bankruptcy exit. Spirit's restructuring plan assumed jet fuel costs of about $2.24 a gallon in 2026 and $2.14 in 2027. But prices had climbed to around $4.51 a gallon by the end of April, leaving the carrier unable to survive without fresh financing. Jet fuel accounts for about a quarter of airlines' operating expenses. The airline flew around 1.7 million U.S. domestic passengers in February with a 3.9% market share, down from 5.1% last year, Cirium data showed. And that article was entitled Airlines Scramble to Help Spirit Passengers, and that was by David Shepherdson and Layla Kearney. Our next article is entitled New Mexico Trial May Force Changes for Meta. The subtitle is State Seeks Billions Over Facebook, Other Sites. This is by Dana Novak-Jones. A trial beginning in New Mexico on May 4th could prompt a judge to order sweeping changes to how Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp operate, a move Meta Platforms has warned could force it to withdraw from the state. The case, which will be tried before a judge in Santa Fe, stems from a lawsuit filed by New Mexico Attorney General Raul Torres, a Democrat, accusing the social media giant of designing its products to addict young users and failing to protect children from sexual exploitation. At the heart of the trial is whether Meta's platforms have created a public nuisance under New Mexico law. That finding would allow the judge to order wide-ranging remedies aimed at curbing alleged harms to young users. The case is being closely watched as states, municipalities, and school districts across the country pursue similar claims seeking to force changes at the industry level. The upcoming trial marks the second phase of New Mexico's lawsuit. A jury in March found Meta violated the state's consumer protection law by misrepresenting the safety of Facebook and Instagram for young users. It ordered the company to pay $375 million in damages. And that is all the time that we have for with this article entitled New Mexico Trial May Force Changes for Meta by Diana Novak-Jones. And this concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 3rd, 2026. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.